Many people, I think, would say, they're honest, that they want to be different. They look inside themselves, they see issues, they see problems. I don't even know if they would put this in moral terms, per se, but they see dysfunction, addiction. I can't stop. I can't start. There's something wrong. And so this is the subject to which Peter is going to turn here in this part of the book, wanting to be different. How can we be different? We read in verse 13, therefore, prepare your minds for action. And remember, whenever we see the word therefore, you ask what it's there for. And of course, it is from the previous verses in context where Peter made this very clear. He said, you know, you never have to doubt the love of God again. That was bought, sold, and paid for at the cross of Christ. We have a permanent clean slate, completely forgiven. I don't know if you've ever heard that before. The death of Christ was so potent and powerful that it paid for our past, present, and future sins. He says we have a place in heaven which is secure, that's never going away. God is just going to heap the rewards on us when we get there. And we can't even fathom what this is going to be like to experience. And so, what is the therefore, therefore? It's all of this. At this point, we need to ask ourselves, what is it that we need to do? And this is the subject to which he turns. He says, prepare your minds for action. This refers to the binding of long garments to facilitate work or walking. Now, back in the day, they didn't have skinny jeans and flannels and stuff. They had robes, skirts, both the men and the women. And so I think that would be actually kind of cool if we could get back into that. I could see that just being pretty relaxed. I could get into that, but we're not into that. So we don't know what this is like. So I brought about a picture here to kind of show what he's describing. Where to do some work, you couldn't be there in a dress. You know, picture the bride coming down the aisle. You know, usually they're really careful, very delicate to pick it up, you know, to gird the dress to help her get down without stumbling, tripping over herself. And in the ancient world, when you went to go out to work or to fight or basically to do anything, you needed to tuck in and bring that back around and wrap it up and then tie it into a knot. And that was a way of showing I'm ready to fight. Or work, whatever. And so he's saying that we need to do this with our minds. To gird up your loins, as the old King James would put it. To put on the jock strap of your mind. Protected. He says, keep sober in spirit. Sober. This at least refers to drug and alcohol sobriety. That we don't want to get drunk, right? Nepho, this is the word. Nepho, nephontes, is the broader term used here. Otto Bauernfeind. Bauernfeind. Otto Bauernfeind. He just sounds more intelligent than me. Otto Bauernfeind says that this refers to the self-evident antithesis to all kinds of mental fuzziness. That's right on the money. To be Nepho, to be sober of spirit, means that you are sharp, you're thinking, you're not fuzzy, you're not cloudy. Of course, this would apply to drunkenness in the sense that when you get drunk, you get really stupid. You start doing stupid things. Why did I do that? Well, I was drunk. I wasn't Nepho. I wasn't sober. Well, Peter's saying here, the same thing is true with regard to Christians, is that we need to get ourselves sharp, aware, not mentally fuzzy. We need to have, as we begin to change our lives to become different, according to the Bible, we need to have a change of mind. Change begins in the mind, is what we're seeing here. Most of us don't believe this. We don't. When we think about this, we think, if I want to change, I need to go out there. The first thing I need to do is go out there and do something. I need to show some moral effort, some kind of a internal ethical reform. I need to get on some kind of a system. And the Bible is teaching here the very first thing, the very first imperative or command in this book is saying, start right here. The battle is right here between my ears. To start thinking clearly, sharply. Most people, they just passively let the parade of thoughts just passively pass right through our minds. They're fleeting. And the thing is about human nature is that when I have a thought, I'm very inclined to believe me. And so when we hear a thought, whether it's self-generated, whether it's intrusive, we get that thought into our head and all of a sudden we start to feel like, oh, that must be true. And instead of questioning what we're thinking, is that even true? I'm feeling bitterness toward that person. I think that they're talking about me by my back. I think that they're out to get me. I wonder what it is that they're even doing. You know, I wonder if they're in my corner. And we get these thoughts popping into our brains, and then all of a sudden, these start to foment and mutate, and we start to actually believe them. And then it becomes a state of belief where we think this is true. And as Paul puts it in 2 Corinthians chapter 10, he says we need to take these thoughts captive. Just think of that imagery, to go in there in war and to take a captive by force. This is the language of our own thoughts. That instead of just being a passive participant in the car, like I'm sitting in the back seat looking out the window, I'm putting myself in the driver's seat, and I'm taking control of what I'm thinking. In our culture, mental lethargy is the norm. Of course, it's true. I mean, it is true that people are into academics more now than ever, and we want degrees. Why? Because we want to become people that have really developed the life of the mind. People that are sharp, people that know about our world. Usually it's for some kind of a utilitarian purpose, that I'm getting a degree just so I can get a job, so I can make lots of money. So it isn't the pursuit of knowledge or to become a balanced, sharp person. It's really just there because I'm trying to make something out of this. I'm trying to turn that degree into money. And people are mentally lethargic. They don't read. If they read, it's something like a fictional book. It's something that's they're skimming. I love hearing people say, oh, yeah, I did some research on this or that. Oh, you did. So you went through the journal articles and you did a summary of the abstracts of each article and you looked at the logical fallacies of each one. And then you went back and reread them and then you compared the alternate side. And these were peer reviewed, I'm assuming. Yeah, right. So you did all your own research. No, I was on YouTube for about 5 minutes, but I got this all figured out. Mentally lazy, and at the same time, we become stimulation junkies. Check this out here. Time spent on IT devices, IT devices, that's short for information technology. This would also include TV, mobile devices. We see from 2014 to 2021, the TV has declined. However, we're still watching 3 hours and 22 minutes per day of television. Shocking. At the same time, during the same period, mobile device use has shot up to 3 hours and 54 minutes. You know what that means? 4 hours. That's what that means. I'm not a math major, but I can round up. In total, this is 7 hours and 16 minutes per day vegging out in a mental stupor with my mouth hanging open, with the drool coming down my chin, looking at a screen. Oh, cat, he can play piano. That's cool. And just completely zoned out. 7 hours a day or 50 hours per week. Dear Lord, that's a full-time job. That's what we're doing here. Or over 60 years from age 18 until the average life expectancy 78, 9.5 million minutes, 159,000 hours, 6,630 days, or 18.1 years uninterrupted, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, 52 weeks a year, you get the point, for 18 years. So. That's not even realistic. You'd die, right, if you didn't sleep for 18 years. So if we were going to put in sleep, this would be 27 years of your life. You're losing your life. Minute by minute, hour by hour. What are you losing it on? What is it? Videos, scanning Facebook pictures. Oh, you want to waste your life. Just sit there and just zone out in some kind of a mental stupor. What a waste of time. And this, I don't know if this is a cause or an effect. You know what I mean? I don't know if this is correlative or this is causative of the absolute mental lethargy. And this is the culture in which we find ourselves. And Peter, this is incisively speaking, just the opposite. We need to take control of our own minds and start to think for ourselves. In other words, God doesn't want to coerce us into doing His will, to following in the footsteps of Jesus. He wants to persuade us. And part of that is that it's incumbent on us to do the study, to read, to think, to prepare our minds, to be sharp. He says, fix your hope completely on the grace to be brought to you at the revelation of Jesus Christ. The hope, fix your hope. Everybody's living for something. You're living for that career. You're living for that special sweetie, sweetheart. You're living for that money, success, achievement, fame. You want to be, so you're living, there's a hope here. He's saying the hope of the Christian is heaven. Fix your hope completely on the grace to be brought to you at the revealing, the revelation, the apocalypse of Jesus, when Jesus reveals Himself, the second coming of Christ, and to be there with Him in all of His glory, standing before the face of Christ with billions of people, with trillions of angels on a restored planet, to be there. He says that is where the mind needs to be focused. It could be focused in a myriad of different areas, but we need to pull it off of that and keep our primary focus on what heaven is going to be like. Then he says, as obedient children. Notice he doesn't say as obedient servants, which we are. He doesn't say that this is some kind of a master-slave relationship. This is relational, the relationship between a father and a son. Do not be conformed to the former lusts which were yours in ignorance. Now, I know some people say, well, I'm not a conformist. I have one word of reply. Really? You're not a conformist? Really? No, I'm not a conformist. No, man, I don't conform in my style, the way I look, the way I dress, you know, my music taste, my hobbies, you know, I'm different, you know. The clothes I wear, you know, they're very vintage, and the music I'm into. Oh man, I'm not into that stuff everyone's into. I'm in the stuff on the ragged edge, you know, Neutral Milk Hotel. Don't you love when you just get laughed at in front of 300 people? Arcade Fire, man, you know, Franz Ferdinand, you know, I'm into all the stuff, you know, Justin Bieber and sometimes. On the weekends, you know. My hobbies, man, you know, my I drink PBR, you know, I'm not like everyone else. So you're a nonconformist. I think the word you're looking for is hipster. Hipster. That's what you are. Now you know. That could be the lesson for you tonight. Now you found out. Well, let's just say that you really are different with regard to your style and your haircut and your facial hair and your music and your hobbies and the books that you read, and you're really avant-garde, you're on the edge, man, you're very non-conforming. Who cares? We're talking here about the most superficial parts of our lives, the way you cut your hair. You kidding me? The way you trim your beard? That's the thing that makes you, oh, that's so special. Oh, you know what I do? I tuck my pants into my socks. I'm a real nonconformist. That's so superficial. Dear God, how about this? What about being a nonconformist with regard to your values? With regard to your worldview? Why is it that you talk to certain people and they say things like this? They'll say, you know, I believe that God is like blank, whatever blank is, you know, an energy, a force, you know, permeating all of the universe, you know, God is the universe, that whatever it is, okay, whatever idea they have. And you say, that's interesting. That's an interesting perspective. Why do you believe that? Huh, I don't know. Never thought about that. Why is it that all your friends in your social group all agree with the same thing? Huh. Why is it that, like, you hold certain values that you think are really important? All your friends hold those same exact values. Why is that? Why do you hold those values? Do you have any reason for holding those values? Now, somebody, I could feel them itching in their gut, saying, oh, wait a minute, you Christians are the same way. You guys are all at a Bible study because you hold the same values and you hold the same worldview. Okay, wait a minute. At the core, yeah, that's true. There is diversity on the peripheral issues in Christianity, for sure. But, at the core, you're right. You're right. Here's the difference. I'm up here saying that I know why I hold those views. I haven't just tacitly adopted these perspectives. I haven't just bought into groupthink and in some kind of, you know, bovine herd, just following the butt of the cow in front of me. I'm just following the way. Yeah, all truth is relative. Did you do a real serious study on epistemology and relativism? Is that what you did? Oh, you took the classes on that. No, I just think, you know, all paths to the mountain are equally valid. On what basis? You can't just make assertions like that. Why do you believe that? And time again, we see people, they have no reason for adopting these views. No reasons. What might that imply? Conformity. That's why he says here, to the former lust. See, the word lust here is epithemia. Epi is the prefix. That means on or over. And themeo, means a desire. So literally, this is like an over-desire. Desires are good. You know, you think of sensual experiences, you know, drinking alcohol, sexual experiences. That would be having sex. Money, achievement, living for something, wanting to be recognized, you know, starting a family. These are all good things. You know, the Bible's into all these things. Yes, it is. Sensual experiences, being able to enjoy some, you know, good alcohol. You know, the Bible actually teaches wine makes the heart of man and God happy. He's happy when we're happy. Sexual experiences. Who do you think invented sex? God. Why is it so, I was going to say orgasmic. I'm going to go with that. Why is it so orgasmic? I mean, it's awesome. It's wonderful. And people are into this. Living for money. I mean, we're a big fan. Here's the problem. Do you see what he's saying here? By using this term epithemeo. These are over desires. They're inordinate. It's not just that we're enjoying sensual experiences. It's that that's my whole life. When's the next drink, drink, drink? It's not enough to enjoy a drink. It's that I gotta have 1, 2, 3, 10. It's not just that I can enjoy a healthy sex life in the way that God designed. It's I've got to go out on the hunt. I got to go out and hook up culture, looking for who it is I can hook up with. And all of a sudden we start to discover this is taking over our very lives. We have become addicted. Jesus was the one who said that sin itself is enslaving. Whoever sins is a slave to sin. John chapter 8. And so these become over desires where God made them to be good, but now we're treating them as God. We're treating them as ultimate. You might say, so we're conforming to these values. We're conforming to the thought forms behind this and the ideology. Really, we could say the cultural script that everyone believes. Everyone just thinks that's just perfectly normal. Everything we just described up there, to live for money, to, you know, everything else. And so what, you know, what's the alternative here? Well, Peter doesn't leave us in the dark. He says, but like the Holy One who called you, be holy yourselves in all of your behavior, because it is written, you shall be holy, for I am holy. Now, this is difficult because when we read that word holy, we don't even know what that means. We've heard that word tossed around so many different times. I bet if you ask 10 different people here, what does the word holy mean? You'd get 10 different answers. We don't know what it means. I'm a fan of when we translate the Bible from the original languages to actually use a word that we use, that we know. And holy is somewhat of an archaic term that we don't even know the content or the meaning. This word hagios, holy, it carries the meaning of being unique. For example, Moses said, who is like you, God? There's nobody like God. Nobody. omniscient, omnipotent, omnibenevolent, all-powerful, eternal, never changing, immutable. Nobody like you. Who is like you? Do you see the connection? Who is like you? Majestic in holiness. That's Hebrew poetry. It's emphasizing. It's actually, it's called intensification. Who is like you? Majestic in holiness. To be holy is to be unique. So, if we were to give a good translation here, we could say words like distinct, different, separate, set apart. Like the unique one, like God is totally unique in all of his attributes. He says, I want you to be unique. I want you to be like me. Like a father and a son, like obedient children. I want you to be like me in this world in which we live. What does it look like to be unique? See, this is where in our Christian culture today, with our fundamentalist friends, they've gone right off the rails on this. They are, self-righteous. That's what they think. In order to show that we're so different, we're so unique, it's not just that we need to be holy, it's that we need to be holier than thou. And we will go out of our way to reveal that to people, show it to them. In fundamentalist culture, they withdraw from quote-unquote sinners. How far that is from Jesus of Nazareth, who was called in Matthew chapter 9, the friend of sinners. That was considered an insult by the religious people of his day. And Jesus was like, guilty as charged. When sinful, I'm talking about like tax collectors, prostitutes, sinful people were thinking to themselves, man, we want to throw a party. Who should we invite? Jesus. Jesus would be the life of the party. He would be fun to have around. Withdrawing from sinners. Ugh. Developing some kind of an insular Christian subculture. I remember sitting with my buddy years ago. We were sitting there in his room and we were in high school and we had snuck a couple beers up to his bedroom, you know, so we were nursing those and we were talking and he was like, hey, bro. I was like, what's up, bro? That's how we talked back then. And he was like, dude, you like Metallica? And I was just like, he's like, I got a band that sounds just like Metallica. Listen to this. He put it on and I was like, they do sound like Metallica. I like Metallica though. He's like, yeah, but this is a Christian band. I was like, cool. I want the real thing. I don't want the substitute. Well, do you like, I like them. Well, I got something that sounds just like that. It's basically Christian culture, fundamentalist culture, trying to imitate secular culture and trying to copy it to make a Christianized version of it. I just think this whole project is so bizarre. Or focusing on biblical teachings that aren't emphasized in the Bible. You meet some of these people. They are some of the most unloving, judgmental, rude people you've ever met. And yet they will focus on the fact that you said a cuss word. That's very offensive to them. You know what? You being so self-righteous is offensive to me. How about that? That's something that the Bible actually emphasizes. Not to be holier than thou, but to realize I'm not any different than anyone else. I'm just forgiven. That's it. So what should be the difference here? What is to be unique? What is to be the mark of the Christian? One word. Love. Love. That is the way we're supposed to stand out. Not as some kind of obnoxious group of people that are so weird and bizarre. And no, we're supposed to be different. Yes. We're supposed to be unique. Yes. People would look at us and be like, what is with that person? There's something different about them. What is it? Oh yeah, they don't listen to Metallica. That's it. Now, how many times do we see in some of our small groups, people will enter one of those groups and just say, I have never seen anything like this. Love. In a world that's glued to a screen, in a world that's becoming increasingly more and more estranged from other people and politically divided, racially divided, ideologically divided, to see people like us that are a pack of strays all brought together loving each other, that is the mark of the Christian. Then he says, if you address his father, the one who impartially judges according to each one's work. So this would be the God at the end of our lives. Since we're forgiven, what's this judgment all about? It's to reward us. That's what the Bible teaches. 1 Corinthians 3, it says that one can actually pass through the fire. He himself will make it, but he will suffer great loss. So you could be forgiven, yet you wasted your entire life. You didn't build anything of any substantive value. So God is going to judge the Christian, but this is going to be a judgment of reward. Yeah, if you address the Father who impartially judges, conduct yourselves in fear during the time of your stay on earth. Now, for years, this really scared me, obviously, because it says, conduct yourselves with fear, the fear of the Lord. And it's also talking about judgment. So that bothered me, too. I thought I had so many problems. I'm sure you can relate. You know what I mean? Like, you look inside. The longer you serve God, the more problems you see. And to be fearful of God, I did feel kind of fearful. I got to be honest. I started to see more issues, more problems. It's quite scary to be standing before a God who can see everything right down into your soul. God is that scary. Is this saying that we're supposed to be afraid of God in the sense of like abject terror, terrified of God, scared of Him, let's say? Well, that Greek word, phobos, this can be translated as being scared. Yes, it can. This is the root from which we get the term phobia. However, it can also be translated astonishment, awe, or wonder, or respect. You know what would be a good word here? Respect, reverence. To stand there in front of God, knowing that at the end of your life, you're going to be looking with Him eye to eye, and He's going to be looking at every aspect of your life, going through that, and I'm looking forward to that future, realizing right now, I guess this means that God is watching. That gives a high level of respect, reverence, to know that everything I'm doing, God is paying attention to all that. I used to take this as a verse that scared me. Now, this is a verse that actually motivates me. How about that? Apathy, the alpha privative, A, not. Pathy, pathos, no passion. That's most people you see. How many people do you see that have a lot of passion in their lives? Not that many. Very dull, very dreary. Apathy could be the word that describes our age. Apathy just surges when? When no one is paying attention to what you're doing. How long would you be working on the job if your boss never showed up? Oh, he was sick the other day and I worked real hard. Yeah, that was one day. I'm talking about day in, day out. You would continue just to be giving your heart to your job, doing all this work, or you'd be sitting there fiddling on your phone. No one's paying attention. Yeah, apathy increases when we're not being rewarded. What's the point of anything I'm doing? What if you got to the end of your life and it just didn't matter? Nothing you did matter. And God's like, it's not that way at all. I'm here. I'm watching everything. I'm watching over everything. There's no goal. There's no mission toward which I'm moving. Why is it that we have our friends that we see and they're just so addicted? They're so dysfunctional. We see it in their lives. They see it. They're hurting, depressed. Anxiety has them turned up into a pretzel. What is that? Why is that? It's because life is so damn boring. That's why. Where am I headed? What's it mean? Why am I here? What's the point? No one's watching. No one cares. There's no evaluation. There's no reward. So what do? I just fill my days stimulating myself in whatever way I can, because it's just so boring. Boredom. We think about that ancient myth of Sisyphus. Greek mythology was the story where they punished this figure, Sisyphus, and they made him roll this rock up the mountain. And then he would go to sleep and he'd wake up, and then sure enough, that rock would roll right back down. And then he'd get up the next day and he'd push it up, and then at the bottom, same thing. And the existentialist, atheistic philosophers picked up on this. They said, you know, what is the meaning of life? There isn't one. You just try and exist. That's it. And you try and squeeze out a meaning. They picked up on this idea of Sisyphus, that really is an archetype, a picture, a prototype of life. What really is horrifying about this picture, when you think about it? Is it the physical labor? No, that can't be it, because I've seen many people, they pay good money to go to a CrossFit gym, and they're, you know, pushing tires over, and I don't know what they do there, but physical labor? No, that's not it. It actually feels kind of good to do a little bit of exercise. Is it the duration? Is it that the gods cursed Sisyphus to do this forever? I just watched The Sandlot last night with my kids, so sorry. No, I'm expecting to go to eternity with God. I can't wait for that. It's never going to be boring. Nothing like that. What is it? What's horrifying about this? Is it the repetition? No, that can't be it either. A lot of the places we like to go on vacation, a lot of the activities we like to do, we'll do those over and over. We still enjoy them. We still like it. Our relationships, our friends, restaurants, vacation spots, that isn't it. What is it? What's the horrifying picture here? It is the complete and utter lack of meaning. That there's no point. What's he doing? He's moving a rock only to have it fall right back to where it was. This is the life of many people that we meet today. No hope. How about this statistic? When you retire, it increases the probability of suffering from clinical depression by 40%. Everyone's always saying the goal is retirement. When I get to retirement, that's what I'm going to be doing. You know, all the stuff I want to do. You know that your depression, clinical depression, increases 40%. And this is in a country where most Americans hate their jobs. So showing up to work at a job that you don't even like is actually giving you some sort of purpose. I'm not saying it's any ultimate purpose, but at least you're getting up and you're doing something in your life. Erich Fromm, the humanist philosopher, he said, the average man today may have a good deal of fun and pleasure. He wrote this in the 50s. Yeah, today we got those people beat, that's for sure. We can do all sorts of things, unimaginable freedoms we're seeing today. But in spite of all this, he is fundamentally depressed. Perhaps it clarifies the issue if instead of using the word depressed, we use the word bored. Actually, there's very little difference between the two, except a difference in degree, because boredom is nothing but the experience of a paralysis of our productive powers and the sense of unaliveness. Among the evils of life, writes Fromm, there are few which are as painful as boredom, and consequently, every attempt is made to avoid it. Isn't that true? What if no one was there? What if no one cared? Oh boy, in our culture, we saw this during the pandemic, that's for sure. When is this going to end? Where are we going? Where are we headed? Where are my friends? No relationships, no goals, everything shut down. The boomers, they went from around 8-9% anxiety and depression disorders up to 29%. That is unbelievable. That's a mental health crisis. These are the people, of course, though, obviously. They were the most at risk for the coronavirus. So, of course, they would be having anxiety. Of course, they would be having depression. The boomers, that makes a total lot of sense. Yeah, sure. How about this, though? Gen Z, 56% were showing symptoms of anxiety or depressive disorders. I don't mean they felt anxious. I don't mean they felt sad. They had the symptoms in the DSM of an anxiety or depression disorder. 56, that is up 5.5-fold, 6-fold of what we've seen in the past. Oh, so I guess that whole idea, that whole thesis that you're going to sit there in front of a screen and we're going to be very autonomous and not be around people and not want to be with people. I guess we got completely glutted with that. We were forced that for a full year. And we discovered that that was complete poison. The thing that we're yearning for actually was the thing that is killing us. We're seeing this. Oh, we could roll out statistics like this. They're on their way too. We're still studying this. And he tells us, he says, you were not redeemed with perishable things like silver or gold from your futile way of life inherited from your forefathers. See, Peter's ahead of us here. If there is no God, if there is no goal, if there is no mission, there's nothing objective, nothing ultimate, it's just futile, it's futility. He says, that's what you were. He says, but you were not redeemed from your former way of life. He says, instead, but with precious blood, as of a lamb unblemished and spotless, the blood of Christ. When God purchased your forgiveness, it wasn't with money. It was with his own blood. You know, it'd be one thing if I told you I love you. It'd be another thing if I showered you with gifts. That would show love too. God has done both. He's spoken that he loves us. He's given us good things to show that he loves us. Here he demonstrated his love. I was talking to one girl who said, you know, when I was growing up, you know, Dad was always away working 80, 90 hours a week. Mom, she was, you know, working. I was raised by somebody. Wasn't even my mom or my dad. But then they would come home and they would, you know, be pouring out all the gifts and the toys and, you know, Christmases were good and, you know, we did vacations. That was nice. I didn't want the toys, you know, I didn't want the stuff. I wanted them. I wanted my mom. I wanted my dad. I didn't want their presence. I wanted their presence. I wanted them to be around. And this is what we're seeing here. I don't know what you've heard about Christianity. God wants to come into your life and love you in a way you can't even imagine. This is unspeakable love. This is love we've never seen before. You've never encountered anything like this. And all we need to do, according to the Bible, is to trust in this, is to say, I believe in Jesus. I believe in what he did for me, and to accept that free gift of forgiveness. And at that moment, you start to discover what Peter means here by the precious blood of Christ. He says this, for he was foreknown before the foundation of the world, but has appeared in these last times for the sake of you. Through him you are believers in God, who raised him from the dead and gave him glory, so that your faith and hope are in God. Now what are we supposed to do? How's he end this? Since you have, in obedience to the truth, purified your souls for a sincere love of your brothers and sisters, fervently love one another from the heart. This is what ends this whole pericope here. You know, spiritual growth begins in the mind, but it doesn't end there. No, it does not. How many people I've spoken to who time and time again have just said, oh yeah, so I've been thinking differently, I've been learning more about God, I've been understanding more about the Bible, and this never translated from the head 18 inches down to the heart, and then out into the hands. I'll leave you with this. I heard this one pastor I like to listen to. He said, do you know what the most important part of a Bible study is? I thought to myself, no, I don't. I wonder what he's going to say. He said, the most important part of a Bible study is the end when you close your Bible. What he meant was, is after this whole study, now what? Fervently love one another from the heart. You will not know what this is like. You will not be different. You will not have a change of life unless you adopt this sacrificial, loving attitude toward other people. You're never going to get this. Take a tiny step tonight forward toward other people. Maybe that person that's kind of difficult to love, particularly that person who's difficult to love. And you'll start to discover every single person, very unique, very interesting, made in the image of God. Every single person, you learn more. And you start to discover just how sweet and awesome it is to get into people's lives. And this is it. This is the life to which we've been called. And that's all we have for this evening.